Good evening. Before I actually sort of go on to Paul, I think it's quite important that you actually know where I'm coming from so you can actually understand where something of my heart is in this subject, which is Paul and the division of the church. I was born in Nakuru, Kenya, actually, and my father was in the army, and I was baptized as an infant at St. Stephen's Church, Canterbury, in an Anglican church. Father and mother, fairly strict, sort of normal, sort of nominal Christians, as sort of a lot of army people are. Quiet people of faith, don't really want to wear it on their sleeves. I went to boarding schools, very Anglican boarding schools, although my second school was actually established by a Baptist missioner to the hop field pickers, the hop pickers in Kent. About 14, I was confirmed and went through a period of, I suppose, unusual for us at a boarding school, all-male boarding school. We actually had quiet Bible studies in our rooms and quite an intense period. I then started studying geology, and I really struggled with my faith as a result of that, and I became an evangelical atheist. Very aggressive. And that, for my time when I was at university, was sort of quite a mark. But then during time at university, I had quite a struggle, and I went for an industrial year out in Manchester. And I had a week's break because my parents were living in Belgium, and it took 24 hours to travel to Belgium from where I was at Aberystwyth University. So I decided not to travel there and back up to Manchester. So I stayed with some Christian friends who I'd got to know during my time at university. And during that time, I read the book The Cross and Switchblade, which very 1950s, 60s book, about a man who prayed. He decided he was a minister in the Pentecostal church, and he put away his watching television late at night and decided to start praying for a couple of hours. And during that time, he felt called to the gangs in New York, and he has a tremendous ministry. Isn't the chap's David Wilkinson, if you've ever heard of him? And in that book, there's a challenging part where he drives round. He's been encouraged to try and meet some boys who've been arrested, and he cannot, the authorities won't let him get anywhere near them. So he decides to try and find their families in the whole of New York City. Has no addresses, has not been allowed that. And he drives around Central Park, and eventually he prays, God, show me. And he starts taking lefts and rights as he's driving, and eventually he parks a car outside a brownstone house in the Bronx, and he gets out and he asks the first man, he says, do you know where this family live? And he says, well, you've parked outside their house. Now, either David Wilkinson was lying or there was a God, was the conclusion I came to at that point, 1 o'clock in the morning, and I came back to Christ. That was 1983. Moving on a bit, I then went to a Pentecostal church in Manchester called Beth Shan Tabernacle, very large church, seated at 1,200, but only had 200 people in it at the time I was there. I grew an awful lot under their tutelage, not so much from the charismatic side or but their love for scripture. Very working class background, but a very strong, dedicated view to discussing and really opening the scriptures amongst each other. And also going out on the streets. A friend of mine took me out on the streets 3 weeks after I sort of really became a Christian, inviting people into church on Sunday night. And the first person I met was a Jehovah's Witness. So. And it was amazing. All that background from when I was at school, I found that I had words to say. Their scriptures were there. Somehow that whole background had been there. I eventually married after some time in London, in a church in London, and we were from a Pentecostal church, as I said, in Aberystwyth, Elim Pentecostal Church, and we naturally went to the Pentecostal church in Abergavenny where we lived, And we walked through the door, and the first thing they said to us was, "Can you preach?" At which point we virtually turned around and never went back, because it just seemed odd to invite a stranger in and got no idea where they came from. We ended up going to an Anglo-Catholic church, which for us was a real big struggle. The first time we walked in there, they were walking around with a statue of Mary, swinging incense, singing a hymn, and we wondered what on earth have we came to come to, and we walked out. Fortunately, a lady came in and said, "This is unusual, come back another time." And also, we heard the man, the vicar, preach, and he was very much a man of the gospel, and I'll come on to what I mean by that in a moment. And and we actually ended up there, and within 6 months I was swinging the incense. And I'll explain how that came about later, and why I think it's important that sometimes we end up finding ourselves in uncomfortable places. But so my background's quite eclectic. I eventually came over to here, to Woodbridge, because I was unemployed at the time, and I got a job at BT, and I was there for 12 and a half years as a full-time employee and 2.5 years as a contractor. And we only came over for 3 months, and we've been here ever since. An opportunity came up for me to go forward for ordained local ministry, which is the idea that you carry on your job, but you're sort of also ordained. And I'm only licensed to the two churches within my parish. I'm officially not allowed to work outside of my parish. So I had to get permission from the bishop to come here tonight, as an example. He's very happy for us to do it. And I was ordained 2.5 years ago. So that's the background. I have 3 children. My oldest one's 18, just. And the youngest one's 13, and my daughter's 16. So that's my background. So quite eclectic background in terms of where I've been, which feels eclectic to me. And my heart in response to most things is pastoral, in terms of, although I am not a pastor, by which I find it hard to necessarily hold pastoral tasks long term, my reaction when I'm faced with struggles about differences is one of pastoral. It's the gathering in that actually is my natural reaction, rather than the pushing away. So just that's where I'm coming from. Now, Paul. Paul was a man acquainted with conflict right from the beginning. He was a Pharisee, so he would have spent hours and hours arguing the minutiae of the law. He would have had huge barneys with the Sadducees about the resurrection of the body, and their whole, quite a lot of his religious life would have been about sparring. It would have been about scoring minute points over things which probably we wouldn't understand and hadn't got the time for. A lot of debate and discussion. He was also very single-minded in his approach. There is no evidence that he met Jesus, but that we do know that the Pharisees were sent out. And sometimes they get a very bad name. I want you to understand that as a Pharisee, they were sent out as almost like an audit commission. They were sent out to check out people and rabbis as they preached, in a way to keep things straight. In some ways, quite a reasonable thing. And you see from the reaction of the Pharisees that sent out quite a contrasting. Some are very contentious, some are very loving in a way. And you have the amazing stories of people like Nicodemus coming to check out, but actually doing it in a reconciliatory way, a way of approach. So that Paul could well have been in that mould, we don't know. But we do know that he very quickly persecuted the church, that he was involved in the stoning of Stephen. He actually stood and watched whilst the clothes were laid at his feet. And his name was Saul at the time. The name Paul comes from the fact it actually means little. I've read once someplace that he was probably only 3.5 cubits tall, they actually called him. So that's probably about 4.5 feet tall. So he was a little man. And little men can quite often be bumptious and pack a punch. People like Nelson and Napoleon were also very short. There's something about stature that can often be overcome by presence. after his conversion on the road to Damascus, where he was going to persecute and where his zealousness effectively was stretching out beyond the natural realms of the Jerusalem church, he was going to the synagogues in Damascus to follow up Christians, Jewish Christians, who would have left Jerusalem probably under persecution and actually been scattered. And one of the things we see is that persecution is often the seed of scattering. It's often the way in which, amazingly, God uses to spread the gospel. And we see him go to Damascus and he meets Jesus on the road. He, during the next few days, somehow is acquainted and made clear that he will suffer. We read that Ananias was told, when he was told to go and pray, that Paul knew that he was going to suffer for the gospel. Yet his single-mindedness carried on after that. So he knew he was going to suffer great pain. He was made very clear right from the beginning that his calling involved suffering. Yet he didn't turn back from it. And we read, it's difficult to work out, but there is some chronology that actually he went into Arabia for 3 years. And we don't really know what he did. But during that time, he developed a gospel, what he called his gospel. And he often refers to my gospel, very personal sense of that. We read that he was actually went back to Jerusalem for a few days and was eventually sent to Antioch, which is in southern Turkey. And amazingly enough, recently they reopened a church in Antioch. A group of Christians were allowed to open a church in southern Turkey, which is very rare. And we read there that he came across a controversy. Peter came to visit him, and Peter, whilst he was with Paul, ate with the Gentiles, had no issues with that, lived as a Gentile. And what that usually meant, for example, a Jew would have to wash his hands in a particular way before every meal. A Jew would have to only eat certain foods, etc. But when Peter came to Antioch, he ate and lived with the Gentiles. For all intents and purposes, he became Gentile in his attitude. But when some Jewish Christians turned up, he reverted to being a Jew, and he separated himself from the Gentiles and started eating only with the Jews. And Paul has it out with him. He really challenges Peter on this hypocrisy and really has it go at him and explains that you can't do this. You can't at one moment be one thing and the next be the other. You've got to be true to your gospel and actually not be divisive in the way you live and look down on one another by the way that you live. And so Paul is obviously not afraid to challenge. And here was an apostle Peter, and here was Paul challenging him on pretty aggressive grounds. Paul is not mealy-mouthed about his challenging of people who had differences. In Philippians, he uses the words, he describes some people as dogs, mutilators of the flesh, enemies of the gospel. He is really quite, and he's talking about apparent Christians here. So he's being quite vicious in his language. He talks in Galatians about, he says to the Galatian, who has bewitched you? In effect, who has taken you over? Who has played magic on you? When they start living a life based on law instead of on grace, when they start following rules and actually are faced with what should they do with circumcision? See, now Paul recognized that we are comfortable with rules. It's much easier to live within a regime where there is nice tight rules. Forgive me, Father Byrne, but the sense of having an order there's a nice rhythm about that. When you work out in some ways one's out in industry or whatever and it's a bit chaotic and people are sending things down, etc., it can actually be quite confusing. And actually, I'm currently unemployed, and having a completely unstructured life is very difficult. When there's no boundaries, it's very difficult. Paul recognized that we needed rules. But he also recognized that rules can also be very damaging to us. His gospel, as I've mentioned, is based around faith. And even though this evening we read from James, he says, if you show me your faith and I show you my works, I'll show. There's a challenge there. So when I talk about the gospel of faith, it doesn't mean to say that we should not go on and work and do things and reach out and support and love other people. That's not what he's talking about. He's talking about the core essence of our relationship with Jesus and with God. It is actually, what is the basis of that? And that is by faith. So he is very, very clear in his condemnation when people start to say, you must be circumcised, to the Christian Gentile men. You see, this talk came about because I mentioned that I quite like Romans, and actually the beginning part of the letter to the Romans is written to a church which is divided. It's written to a church which contains both Gentiles and Jews. It's written to a church who Paul knows some of them, but he doesn't know all of them. He's never been there. And it's amazing how, in fact, he has the presumption to actually challenge them on where they stand. He doesn't know them. But what he does is he very clearly takes the Jews and challenges them on what they stand on. He then takes the Gentiles and challenges them on their former lifestyle. And he effectively pulls them both down to a level where he can actually build them both up together. And what we see in the beginning part of Romans is Paul invokes the story of Abraham as a man of faith, as the basis for why both Gentiles and Jews should be a people of faith and not a people of outward expressions of the fact that the marks of things like circumcision in particular should not be the mark that marks out a person. And he does that because if you go back to Genesis and you look at the story of Abraham, you see that Abraham was given a promise. You will be the father of many nations. And his name was changed from Abram to Abraham. Now, at that point, Abraham believed. And because he believed, it was accredited to him as righteousness. Now, righteousness is not being good. It is not a way of which we are. It's not an expression that. It's about being right with God. On the Alpha course, which I look after at my church, Nicky Gumbel uses this picture which I found really helpful. This is us. Before Adam and Eve fell, their relationship between them and God was one of no barrier. But when they fell, sin became the barrier. And that sin is the barrier between us. We became unrighteous. But when Jesus came, and when he died on the cross, he took our sins upon himself so that the barrier between us and God was removed. And through his death on the cross, because of his righteousness and because of his sinlessness, he took those sins and he destroyed them. And so his relationship was not affected by that. Although we see on the cross, he says, why have you forsaken me? Because for a time, somehow, and we don't necessarily understand it, it is a mystery, he was separated from his Father for us, so that we might no longer be separated from our Father. And that's the gospel. That's what righteousness is. It's being brought back into relationship with God. Now that's what happened with Abraham. It was credited to him as righteous. Not that Abraham was good. We read on that his wife gives him a servant, Hagar, which he has sex with, and eventually Hagar gives birth to Ishmael, and it causes all kinds of problems. We read that God blesses Ishmael, but actually sends him away with Hagar, and actually divides Hagar away from the family, and eventually we have Isaac born, the child of promise. Abraham did some horrible things. He almost had his wife married off to a king of Egypt because she was so beautiful, and he was worried that because she was so beautiful, that if he said it was his wife, that he would actually be killed and the king would take him away. So he was a bit of a scaredy cat, and he said that she was his sister, and you know, it could have gone all pear-shaped. But somehow, even despite that unfaithfulness and apparent sinfulness, his faith, his original faith, was credited to him as righteousness. And that's what Paul invokes. And why does he do that? Because for the Jews, Abraham was prior to the law. Abraham was credited with righteousness prior to being circumcised. The circumcision was a sign of what had taken place. It wasn't the circumcision that made him righteous. It was his faith that made him righteous. And as a result, Paul explains that when a Gentile believes and his faith has faith, they also are credited with righteousness, and they become a child of Abraham's. They become an heir of Abraham's. And it is really important that for that community to be effectively both taken back to their roots, which is Abraham. It's interesting, today Abraham is still the father of nations. It's still the issue that is at the heart between the Muslim faith and our faith. It is still a struggle there. But there is a sense in which we need to understand that Paul's gospel was a gospel about faith, and about understanding that it was a basic being credited, allowed to become back into relationship with God, not because of anything we deserve, not because we've done anything. In fact, exact opposite, it is because what Jesus has done for us that we can be brought back into that relationship. And Paul would not vary from that view at all. In fact, in one of the letters he says, if I come to you preaching a different gospel, you must ignore me. And he was faced with he even goes in Philippians, his very last letter, which was written when he was in prison in Rome. He goes on to say that he doesn't really worry about the motives of why people preach, but as long as they preach the same gospel, he doesn't really mind it. So we see that if somebody preaches a gospel of faith out of selfish ambition, as long as they're preaching the gospel of faith, it's not Paul has no worries about that, which is quite a stark thing. We sometimes question the motives of somebody and therefore stop listening to what they say because we suspect their motives, whereas Paul says actually sometimes the motives might be wrong but the message may be right. And in fact, there are examples. I've read a book from the Christian Businessmen's Fellowship, and they held a conference, and they invited a man to come and preach, an evangelist, and this evangelist suddenly decided to take a collection which they hadn't planned, and that collection was purely for the evangelist. He had a weakness for money, but his message was one of reconciliation to God, and actually a lot of people were touched. His motives may have been wrong, but actually people were touched. And Paul is very clear, as long as the gospel is preached in a very clear way and is very understood, the motives he's not so worried about, which is quite a, you know, that's sometimes we don't take that view. We judge very quickly on what people's motives are. And because he was passionate about this idea of faith and grace being credited to us, he just was very cautious in how he dealt with people. In one stage he said, I become all things to all men. He would change the way he would outwardly live his life in order to reach people. So if that meant he had to live for a time without stuff and support himself and maybe live on meager rations and actually struggle, he would do that if it meant that people were reached for Christ. If it meant that actually for a time he had to live it up a bit and actually reach people who were perhaps a bit more well off, then he would do that too. If he had to be reaching the Jews, he would be Jewish and he would do the ritual washing, etc. But if he was with the Gentiles, he would be very cautious about not offending them by being over Jewish. And so what we see in Paul's approach to division in the church, and one of the things I said this morning is that fact that I think we sometimes have a rosy-tinted view about what the New Testament church how it was, a sense in which it was all together. And we read in Acts how they, you know, the four things, how they broke bread and had fellowship with the apostles and they prayed and all the rest of it, and they shared everything together, and isn't it all cozy and nice? But actually, Paul's letters, written 30 years after that, are virtually all written to churches that are struggling with division. The second letter to Corinthians is all about healing divisions. The first letter to Corinthians is all about having a right relationship with each other and actually living right as an expression of the faith. You find that there is, if we're not careful, the divisions that we have today, we sometimes think are new and different, but actually they're fairly ancient and they have roots right the back then. One of the differences is that actually we've given ourselves labels and institutions that mean it's quite a lot harder to break down those divisions because we've written it down, which is actually very clearly written down. But Paul was passionate that his underlying gospel should not be watered down and should not be used as a divisive thing. It was not something, if you shared that, you shared something positive. However, there are some other things. At the end of the letters to Rome, he talks about the way in which people work out their faith. In fact, the way they express their faith, the way they live it. And he talks about a few things. He talks about meat eaters and vegetarians. He talks about how if the reason it was an issue is that all the meat in those days was sacrificed. Usually the butchers had a pet idol, and when they killed the beast to make the meat, they would actually be sacrificing it to the idol, and then they'd sell the meat off. So there was a sense in which the act of at slaughter was always linked to idol worship in some way. And so for some Christians, they felt that meat was tainted, and so therefore they couldn't eat it. For them, they lived on vegetables because they couldn't eat the meat, because they felt in some way they were giving credence to the idol to which that meat had been sacrificed. For other Christians, it's no problem at all to get on and eat it. You know, it's meat, God's given us everything. I don't know if any of you have been to China, but they eat literally everything. They take God's, eat everything that's given. They really take it literally. But you see, there is a view there. So there was a clash between Christians about some who ate meat and some who didn't. And there was a tendency for one side to look down on the other. Have you ever come across an evangelical vegetarian, and you sit there and you eat a hamburger in front of them, and the disdain that you can sometimes receive is high? Likewise, you sometimes come across carnivores. I have a friend who was a vegetarian and then has become the other way. He's so carnivorous, it's strange. But anyway, you can see the sort of contempt can be so easily passed on each other. And when you add faith into that, as in, this is your walk with Jesus, you can see that sometimes it takes a big tinge. It can sometimes be quite divisive over something as simple as eating meat or vegetables. And Paul says, this must not be. If you offend your weaker brother or sister in your actions, you are in the wrong. So if by your eating meat you are hurting and encouraging somebody to do something which for them would not be an act of faith, you must not do it. Very clear. He goes on, he talks somewhere about drink, and so you find, for example, in the way the Salvation Army's approach to alcohol was one, well, it's easier for us all not to drink. Because then it means if we have people who have struggled with drink coming into our midst as we reach out to them, then at least they know that they're safe in our environment. So rather than any of us doing, and quite a few of the Methodists used to be the same. I was quite surprised when I went from the Pentecostal church to the Anglican that one of the first meetings I went to was in a pub. Quite a shock for me. But you can see that sometimes some things that we think are perfectly natural, other people find very difficult. And Paul says, don't let that divide you. Don't let your attitude to something become bigoted over things which are how you work out your faith. The expressions of how you do that. You could say that, for example, goes with the way we worship. Whether we worship through reading liturgy and very word-oriented, or whether we worship through silence, or whether we worship with loud music and drums, or whether we worship through very simple, plain chant. Those things are not to be used to divide us. They're to be used as a way by which we gain strength and we should encourage one another. So if you've got people who would find a louder service to go on and that would really encourage them and build them up, fine, encourage them, build them up. If it's silence that people need, we'll encourage them in that. And it's a sense in which it's about building one another up is the importance. And that's what Paul says. Quite often he talks about building one another up in love. Really, his emphasis is about don't do things which are going to cause people to struggle. He also talks about special days, strangely, with St. Patrick's Day. One of the issues about some people in those days regarded special days. And it's not clear whether he's actually talking to the Jewish Christians, who may well have still tried to keep the Jewish calendar and the festivals, Passover and Tabernacles and the like. But of course today we have, you know, in the Anglican Church and the Catholic Church, we have Saints' Days and the like. And in my wing, let's put the badge on, I'm an evangelical charismatic with a small C, spirit-filled, not necessarily loud. And it's very easy for us to get divisive over things like special days. From my Pentecostal background, I was brought up to be an Easter person. I'm living after the resurrection. I'm living in a time of grace. I'm living in a time when actually Jesus has given us all that we need to live the life through. That doesn't mean to say we're going to be without problems, but we're a Easter people, and in somehow our working out of our life is in response to Easter. So for me, when I first came into the Anglican Church, the whole idea of Lent was a struggle. Why bother going through this dark time? And Holy Week was a real struggle because people got really emotional over Maundy Thursday and Good Friday. But I'm thinking, well, I'm already living on Sunday. And so found it quite difficult. But you can see, you can start to look down on people. Likewise, people might look at me and think, why does he not get worked up about the fact that we've got Maundy Thursday coming and it's Good Friday and surely we should be have a downcast and recognise that. And you can get sort of funny about these things. And Paul says, bear with one another. If somebody regards it as special, go along with it. It's not a problem. And it's because it's not affecting your underlying gospel of faith and righteousness through faith, bend. Bend in the wing. That's how I ended up swinging the incense. We had a man who used to swing the incense at my Anglo-Catholic church who would swing the incense and then disappear into the vestry, never listen to the sermons. And eventually the vicar said, this can't be. You've got to be part of the congregation or not. You can't just pick the bits you want to do. You've got to be part of the congregation. By all means, come and swing the incense, but be part of the congregation and listen and come under the word. But the man refused. And I don't know why, vicar's sense of humour or whatever, he asked if I would swing the incense. Now, he knew I came from a Pentecostal background, had nothing to do with that. So I went away and I looked up in the Bible about incense. And one of the stories about incense is the story of the brothers Korah, I think it is, where they were not Levites and they were not allowed to use incense. Incense was set aside for the Levites to use. In fact, a small part of the family of Levites. And some people decided not to follow that rule and they ended up dying. And so there's a sense in which it's better to have somebody who believes do that than to have somebody who has no faith, who just sort of somehow is doing the actions but doesn't really know. So in the end, I started swinging the incense. I could never stand this close to people and swing incense in their face without smiling. And as a result, it became quite a joyful time. I did it for about 6 months, and then we found we didn't really need it anymore. It didn't sort of add to our services anymore. But and through doing that, somehow we built bridges in our church, which was quite fractured from those who'd been there for a long time and those of us who were probably more evangelical but really actually found a home there. And somehow, by me swinging incense and other people doing things who weren't necessarily from the old side of the church, suddenly we started having relationship with one another. They started to listen to what was being said more. And actually, I told a story of a lady called Thelma. She was a tutter, you know, one of those people, nothing you did was right, everything. It was written on her face. Her face was very bitter, very, very tortured. And Thelma, for about 3.5 years, 4 years, kept coming, but it was always moan, moan, tut, tut, stiff, you know, sort of. And eventually, she listened, and she believed. Somehow, she came to understand that it wasn't about what you did, it was about your heart, and about how you were. Amazingly, her face changed. She became radiant. Within a few weeks, she had actually had a knitted doll made for the two families in the who just had babies. She would never have done that before. So my son received a little man, a knitted doll, who became his favourite toy. Absolutely amazing transformation. She renewed her baptism vows in the river at age 80 in Abergavenny. And we saw many things like that happen. And it was, I feel, partly because for some of us we took risks about saying, well, actually, I may not understand what this is about, but it doesn't actually change who I am in Christ. So I may as well do it and accept it. So Paul makes this distinction between things which are damaging to one's faith and actually render your faith useless, because he was really worried that people would end up going back to the law and back to a set of regimes which are actually binding rather than recognizing the freedom they had in Christ. Now, that doesn't mean to say that Paul was against order. We can sometimes get that the sense that he wasn't a man of order. He was. We see that in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, where he talks about the Lord's Supper. He is concerned that people in Corinth are coming together, they're rich and poor, and the rich are stuffing their faces and not sharing their food with the poor, and the poor are going home empty at the end of the evening, and they've apparently shared the Lord's Supper together. And he said, that can't be. You've got to share. It's got to be orderly. Now, if you're hungry, eat at home. Don't indulge yourself in front of others and not share it. And he then goes on and explains the institution of the Lord's Supper. And he explains now that we are to examine ourselves before we are to take it, which is why the Anglicans, I don't know whether you share the peace in your Mass, but we have the peace, and that's what that is about. It's about making sure that you are at peace with your brothers and sisters before you take the bread and the wine. There's a sense in which he is encouraging order. So he's not against order. That order, so one has to be very careful that actually when he says that he's against laws, he's talking about laws that bind, not order that actually encourages and builds up. I'm now going to talk about something controversial. I debated whether I should do it. It probably, I don't know, but anyway, I'm going to. Whenever you hear somebody talk, so when this man preaches, or when anybody preaches, do the so what test. Ask the question, so what? What has been said? Does it change me? What is this going to do for me? It's no good me just coming and giving you a homily about St. Paul and how he dealt with division if we don't actually look at the divisions that are between us. If we don't actually look at how we approach each other in our relationships as Christians from different churches, where we see that actually we find ourselves both in some ways split by doctrine, but also in the way we work out our faith. So we end up having to look at those things. So I'm going to look at the Lord's Supper. I'm going to look at the idea of the Mass. And I'm going to look at that because I think it's important. It really pains me as a Christian that somehow this one institution, the thing instituted by Jesus, along with baptism, is used to divide us. It should be the meal that we share together that builds us together. Yet somehow it has become divisive. I read the 39 articles which were written at the time, 1538, around the time that this place was shut down originally. And it uses, I think, vile language towards the Roman Catholic Church. It pained me to read it. It made me think, why are we still got these things? Why am I effectively made to affirm some form of allegiance to these things? When, as I told you, I'm an evangelical Christian. In theory, I should be for the Reformation. I should be for that. So, but when I read them, I find them actually, they refer to some of the practices that are carried out in the Roman Catholic Church as repugnant. That makes me very sad. When the spectrum of people, when you look at the Lord's Supper, in fact, you have the Salvation Army who are off the end of the spectrum because they don't take the Lord's Supper. They have a view that if you rely on sacraments, that actually it's somehow that you're weak in your faith. So putting them to one side, which is sad, and I'll explain a story where we got around that. There is sort of the next part on that is, in fact, people who believe in when the act of sharing communion, that the presence of Christ is not in the bread and the wine. It is a memorial meal. It is an enactment of what went on. So when Jesus said, "This is my body," it is a figurative language, and "This is my blood." He's not talking about that bread and the wine becoming the body and blood of Christ. He's talking about it figuratively. So there's one, the end camp is real absence, memorial. And you would think in some ways that a lot of the evangelical churches would be at this end. A lot of them, say, Baptist or... but you actually find that they're not quite so extreme. The other end of the scale is those people who believe in the real presence, which for most it would be the Catholics, who would believe in either transubstantiation, or there's some other of your theologians refer to things like transfinalization, the idea that some notion that it actually works out in somebody's life, or transignification, the idea that actually the act of being consecrated changes the significance of the bread and the wine for people. There's a presence. Martin Luther, amazingly enough, is in the middle. He had this idea of consubstantiation, the idea that the bread and the wine somehow has some significance, that it is the body and blood of Christ, but it is also still bread and wine. So there is some blurring of the edges. And what you find is that people have put in these doctrines and explanations, but actually the words in 1 Corinthians refer to none of that. They just talk about, at the Last Supper, our Lord took bread, he broke it, he gave thanks for it, and he shared it. No explanation of what it means, no explanation of how it's supposed to impart grace to us, no explanation of how we are to actually react to it, but the fact that that's what happened. It pains me that we cannot somehow come round that. Even a person who may be at one end of the scale. When I first did my first communion, because I come from this evangelical side, nobody told me what to do with my hands. So I stood there at the table with my hands locked underneath, not really sure what to do. I didn't know whether to wave them or lift them up or do whatever. Nobody had explained it to me. But then I went to a curate friend of mine, who's an Anglo-Catholic, to his first communion, and it was a real blessing to see the way that all the servers and everybody got round him, and his priest had the book open and was running his finger down the page to make sure he didn't lose his place, and there was somebody whispering in his ear to make sure he did it the right things, and there was somebody mopping his brow because he sweats a lot, and there was just such a feeling of actually people pulling together around this meal. It had me in tears. Now, he's from an Anglo-Catholic background. Real presence. I would tend to be from the real absence. But if going on what Paul talks about, he talks about us understanding how we work that out. Is that actually down to our basic faith, our righteousness, our relationship between us and God? It's an outworking of our relationship with Christ. I think it is important that we don't use that to divide. It's my heart that somehow we could work to see that at times, if you came to my church, I would welcome you to the table. And I don't say that, but I didn't come this morning to Mass. I'll tell the story and I'll correct it. When I asked Magdalene, could I do that? She said, well, don't wear your collar. And I thought that was because everybody would know I was Anglican. But the reason it would be odd, apparently, is because normally a priest would come and co-celebrate, but I wouldn't know what that was, so I couldn't have done that. So rather than tread on toes and make mistakes, etc., I didn't. But my heart is that we could actually share that meal together, because that meal was designed and set apart for our Lord to build one another up, not to divide. We had a passion play in Woodbridge. A lady from our church took the Matthew's Gospel, and passion, by the way, means to be done unto. So it's all the part in the Gospels from the time when Jesus is arrested to the time of his resurrection, when stuff is being done unto him. We completely take the word passion and use it the other way. It becomes an activist word. It's actually a passive word. It's about being done unto. And so when you talk about the passion play, it's all that section where it is being done, Jesus having stuff done unto him, the scourging and the like. And she took this, and we had a man who's a great actor, do Jesus. There was loads of us who were roped into being his disciples. One man I only know as Judas. I can't remember what his real name is, but I still say to him, hi there, Judas. He comes from the Baptist church. It was done by churches together in our local town. And so this non-priestly man, I don't even know which church he goes to, said the words from Matthew's Gospel of the Last Supper. And we shared bread and grapes with all those who came to watch, whether they were Catholic, Salvation Army, Anglican, believers or not. We shared the bread and the grapes with them, even though they're children or old, and it was fantastic. It was something of, I think, the spirit of what the communion meal is about sharing together. And somehow, just by a little sleight of hand of changing the wine to grapes, somehow we were able to get round that thing that was so divisive. And it was a really special occasion. I'd never realised that Jesus had been part of that communion. I'd never realised that until there we were standing there, and there's Judas standing over the way receiving the bread and the wine just like everybody else. I think that says something special. I think that says it's quite a mark of that. Do you see, I feel and would hope that somehow in my generation we can look at things that divide us, and we can look at those things, and we can look and say, does this change who I am in Jesus? Does this change what my faith is? And if it doesn't, well, then maybe I can understand that. I think part of the reason I told you my history is when I was in the Pentecostal church, they were very aggressively anti-Catholic. The thought of me saying what I've just said, some of those people would find very difficult to understand. There'd be some people in my church who would find it very difficult. There are other issues which divide us. There are other issues that we might find difficult. The veneration of Mary, for example, would be one that was brought up this morning. Praying to saints, we would find very difficult and not really understand that. But I've learned that in a lot of cases, it's not what the institution that says that's important. It's actually what people do on the ground. It's how we relate one to another at the low level that actually has the mark of Christ more than actually what's written in the 39 Articles or in the Council of Trent documents or whatever else. And I think that it's beholden to us. The so what for us about this is, what are we going to do about that in our relationships to other Christians? They may well express their in weird and wacky ways as far as we're concerned, but do we look at them and say they're children of God? They're working it out. They might not have it fully understood, so who am I to actually knock them? Can I encourage them in any way? You see, in John's Gospel, chapter 1, in that famous passage where it says, in the beginning was the Word and the Word was with God, it uses these words: he gave us the right to be children of God. He gave us the right to be children of God. Rights have to be exercised. Rights come responsibilities. Part of that right of being a child of God is actually recognizing other children of God and making sure that we don't exclude them and we don't do anything to damage them and we encourage them. The three, the two main commandments, you know, love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your strength and all your mind, and love your neighbour as yourself. But Jesus added, this I also ask you, love one another as I have loved you. He prayed in John 17 that we would be one as he and the Father is one. That prayer has still to be answered. I think we have a responsibility as children of God to do something about answering that prayer. And it's about how we relate to one another and how you relate to your neighbours and how you relate to people of faith in Christ and how you, what you do to encourage them rather than discourage them. And I think that's the so what of when we look at Paul. We see he had a very basic view of faith being really important. Faith in a Jesus. Don't forget, Paul was a murderer. Yet we read in Philippians that he said, forgetting what is past, I press on to that for which God has taken hold of me. And that goal was to see that people would come to that knowledge of Christ. And that we each have been taken hold of by God. We each have a purpose, and we must live that purpose out. And I can tell you that one of those purposes is not to knock and denigrate other Christians. It is not to put down people who don't express their faith in the same way as you and I do. It is to build them up and encourage them and do whatever you can. Paul says, if it is down to you, do whatever you can to live at peace with one another. And I think that's the call of Paul. When he looks at division, it was gathering in. His heart was to gather in. There are times, and I'm not, you know, Father Bernard can confirm this, there are times when you have to preach a very difficult gospel. Sometimes there are things going on in people's lives which require hard words. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about the idea that some people find themselves doing things wrong and actually need challenging. We all need challenging. What I'm talking about is finding ourselves in how we react to people who we find are different. I'll give you a very simple example. In my Pentecostal church, there was an issue over rock music, and I love country music. I actually love all sorts of music, actually. But there was a real challenge about at the time about how could people like Cliff Richard be a Christian and yet still be in that world and be so rich, etc. And the conclusion I came to in the end was, it's not my job to look at how Cliff Richard is as a Christian. It's not my job. My job is to encourage him in his walk of faith, if that ever came my way. It never has. But I don't need to pull him down. Do you see what I mean? We can end up questioning each other and judging each other by what we apparently see. I'll give you another example. When I first became a Christian, I was a smoker. I had so many people said, why are you smoking? Don't you know your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit? And they gave me such a hard time, and it was really difficult to get rid of it. Eventually, God touched my life. I remember in a meeting, And it was removed from me completely. I knew that I didn't need to smoke anymore. But it was in his time, not theirs. We are so quick to look at people and say, why are you doing that? Well, they may well actually be struggling with anger, and smoking is minor. You know, they may well be struggling with a completely different addiction that you don't know about. And so who are you to judge them and to make a decision about them? And Paul makes it very clear we're to be very careful how we deal with people. And that includes non-Christians. That includes people who have no faith, people who do not share our faith. We're to be encouraging and uplifting to them as well in our approach, that maybe one day they might see that by us being together as one, they might know that we are disciples together. Jesus said, this is how they'll know that you love one another. So that's my heart, and I hope it's Paul's heart, definitely. And maybe it can be all of ours from now on. So bless you.